Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. This figure of speech Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So Jesus again said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep."
Barbara Brown Taylor, in her book, The Preaching Life, tells the following. She says, in Palestine today, it is impossible to witness a scene that Jesus almost certainly saw 2,000 years ago, that of Bedouin shepherds bringing their flocks home from the various pastures they have grazed during the day. We were in Bethlehem and went to the shepherd's field, and they have a field that they've set aside as the shepherd's field. Don't know if where the shepherds were supposed to have seen the angels when Jesus was born. Could have been. There's a big cave there and other things, but there were no sheep. So she's right. Didn't see the sheep like you would have seen 2,000 years ago, because Bethlehem was the place of sheep and shepherds. So often these flocks will end up at the same watering hole around dusk, so that they get all mixed up together, 8 or 9 small flocks, turning into a convention of thirsty sheep. The shepherds do not worry about the mix-up. When it's time to go home, each one issues his or her own distinctive call, this special trill or whistle, or a particular tune on a particular reed pipe, and that shepherd's sheep withdraw from the crowd to follow their shepherd home. They know their shepherd's voice. They know who they belong to. And it is the only one they will follow. So this is what Jesus is talking about here, that his sheep know his voice. Verse 2, the man who enters by the gate is the shepherd of his sheep. The watchman opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he has brought out all his own, he goes on ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. There's this relationship between a shepherd and the sheep. So what is the context of this passage? Well, he has just healed a blind man on the Sabbath, and the Pharisees are angry because they think that Jesus is leading people astray, or he's leading people to come to him, and they think he is a heretic, or maybe they're probably jealous. But Jesus responds to them. His response is this, by equating what is happening in Israel with a shepherd and his sheep. So he uses this particular metaphor. So what I want to do this morning is look at this passage from three perspectives, or three aspects of the story. The first one is the sheep. The second one is the thieves that come. And the third one is the shepherd. So the sheep, the thieves that come, and then the shepherd. So let's look at the sheep first. So sheep are prey animals. You knew that, right? When you're in trouble in the wild, you don't want your pet sheep to show up to save you, right? Doesn't work. That they have no ability to defend themselves against a pack of wolves or some other predator. They are prey animals. It's one of the reasons they stick together for the most part, because it's more difficult for a wolf to pick out a sheep when they're flocking. And that's why a shepherd will take them into a sheepfold at night, especially so that they can be protected from the wolves. So sheep notoriously follow the leader. One sheep goes in a particular direction and the rest will run right after it. There's an article, a BBC article. This is way back, July 8, 2005, that I found. And there's a story of 400 sheep that died. It says that Turkish shepherds watched in horror as hundreds of their sheep followed each other over a cliff. That's what the newspaper reported. First, one sheep went over the cliff, and only to be followed by the entire flock. They all went over the cliff with that one sheep. More than 400 sheep died in that about 45-foot fall. More than 400 died, but there were 1,100 of them that went over. So the first 400 died, the rest of them bounced off of the ones that were already down there because they were fluffy, you know, fluffy sheep. So they all went off the cliff, but only 400 died. It's kind of humorous. Sheep are very social. They're very social. They need to have other sheep around to be okay. But they can bicker with one another. They don't get along with each other. They're skittish. They're prone to wander. They don't know what is best for themselves. They can't take care of themselves. They can't provide for themselves. They can't control their environment or anything, really. They're just there. In his book, A Shepherd Looks at Psalm 23, Philip Keller, who was a shepherd for 8 years, he has some insight into what it is, what sheep are like. He tells us that sheep cannot rest unless four things are true of them. Four things have to be right for them to be able to rest. Number one, because of their timidity, they cannot rest unless they're free from all fear. They need to be in a protected environment where they know the shepherd is there and they're free from all fear. Number two, because they're social, they cannot rest unless they are free from friction with other sheep. Number three, they will not rest if they're tormented by flies or by parasites. Keller says that they put this salve on their eyes and other places to protect them from the parasites. And number four, they cannot rest if they're hungry. These are all the things that a shepherd needs to take care of for the sheep so that they can actually rest. So for us, the analogy that Jesus makes here in this passage seems like this quaint little, wonderful little story taken from a nice little farming community. But for the people in Jesus' day, they knew all of these things. They knew what a sheep was like. They knew the things that needed to happen. So they understood the entire context when he was talking about, I am the shepherd of the sheep. And he was calling them the sheep. They had good knowledge about what caring for the sheep was. So basically what Jesus is telling the Pharisees is that sheep are vulnerable, right? They understand that. Sheep are vulnerable. And this is exactly what he's telling us. And it's exactly what he was telling the people around him. We are a vulnerable people. We try to act like we're not. We try to earn money to minimize our vulnerability. We put walls up between us and those that would harm us so that our vulnerability would be minimal so as not to get hurt. We live safety obsessed. We protect our children from everything. We minimize our vulnerability in the workplace and at home, and on it goes. We're vulnerable, but we don't want that. So we work in every way we can to not be vulnerable. We work hard to live secure and safe lives. But how do you protect against the shooter that comes in and kills people in a bowling alley in a bar? People that felt, I'm sure, perfectly safe and secure in those places. And you get a shooter and they're dead. How do you protect yourself from forces beyond your control that invade your country and leave mayhem? And I don't care which side of any side we're on, there's a lot of innocent victims. In Israel, in Ukraine, and everywhere else. How do you protect against that? How do you remain in control when you lose your job? How can you stop from getting old? How can you protect yourself from disease or illness? How do you protect yourself when someone breaks into your home? How do you protect yourself from harsh words of people around you? See, we're vulnerable people. We don't want to act like it. We want to act strong. Like we have it together, all together. But what Jesus is teaching here is that we're sheep. We are vulnerable people. Well, of course, in our society, all kinds of advice is doled out for how to protect yourself, how to be less vulnerable. If you eat better and exercise, you'll protect yourself from illness. But of course, that's certainly not foolproof. You can get sick. You can get sick. You can carry a weapon to protect yourself from violence. But of course, that's not foolproof either. You can insist on safe spaces at your university so that you don't hear any harsh words against you. But of course, you're probably at some point in your life going to hear harsh words against you. You can't protect from that, right? You can worry and you can fret about your kids and put a wall of protection around them, limit their exposure to danger, but we all know that there's only so much we can do. We can't control them at all, and they could be easily get hurt or be sick or vulnerable. We are vulnerable, vulnerable. Unless you go and live in the desert like a hermit, you can't protect yourself. Of course, you can't even protect yourself in the desert, even if you're living as a hermit in the desert. So the description of sheep here is not very different from who we are. We need a shepherd. We need a hero. We need someone to follow. We need someone that will look out for us, that will fight our enemies, that will bring peace, that will take care of pesky parasites, that will feed us, because we can't do it. We can't do it. But the question is who? Who will do that? Well, number two, let's look at the thieves. So the thieves that Jesus has in mind are the Pharisees, of course. But he tells us in verse 1 and in verse 10. Verse 1 says, I tell you the truth, the man who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate but climbs in by some other way is a thief and a robber. And verse 10, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. We already know from chapter 6 to 8 of John that the religious leaders want to kill Jesus. They have had enough of him. They hated him because he was calling into question the very foundation of their religiosity. He had accused them of abandoning the true law of Moses and leading people down a path of destruction. And think about how true all of this rings at the end of Jesus' life. There he was before Pilate, in front of a large crowd, and the scriptures say that the religious leaders stirred up the crowd so that they would scream, "Crucify him, crucify him. Let his blood be upon us and our children." Talk about leading lambs to the slaughter. Leading an entire flock over the cliff. They were asking Pilate to crucify the very one that gave him breath and sustained them in their lives. And they had no idea. They were dumb sheep, vulnerable sheep, following each other off the cliff. Brothers and sisters, we need to follow someone, but who will it be? There are many, many voices out there. In his book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Carl Truman talks about our culture and how we have gotten to where we are. I've mentioned this before. So where are we? Well, he borrows a term from the great sociologist Charles Taylor to describe our generation. And Charles Taylor calls it a generation of expressive individualism. Expressive individualism. And this is how Truman defines that term, expressive individualism. He says this: cultures are preoccupied with the self-actualization and fulfillment of the individual because there is no greater purpose that can be justified in any ultimately authoritative sense. So what Truman essentially says is that ethics becomes a function of feeling. Or to put it in another way, right and wrong depends on how you feel about it. That is the modern view of morality. But he says that this position didn't come around in just a vacuum. It started with the Enlightenment. And he uses many, many sources, but he boils it down to just three. Jean-Jacques Rousseau was a philosopher of the 18th century who gave energy and life to the Enlightenment. And he was the first to give people permission to find meaning inside of themselves. Took a long time to grab hold, but it's here now in full bloom. And then the second person he talks about, main person he talks about, is Sigmund Freud, who sexualized meaning and identity. And we're not very far from that now. Everybody's identifying themselves sexually. That's what identifies you. And then third is Karl Marx, who politicized everything. And we are in that generation where everything is political. So what this has morphed into is that our society now values freedom above all else. We say, well, wait a minute. I like that word. I like the word freedom. That's a good word. And it's true. It's actually a good thing. It's actually freedom. It's a collective good that keeps oppression at bay. Real freedom keeps oppression down. People in a free society can think for themselves and they can come together to promote a collective good. It's how you work for justice and things like that. So freedom is a good thing, except that now freedom, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, has come to be defined as the absence of any limitations or constraints on us. You should be allowed to do whatever it is that you want to do. But does it really work? In his TED Talk, The Paradox of Choice, secular psychologist Barry Schwartz claims that many of us live by this unspoken but official dogma: maximize your happiness by maximizing your individual freedom. And according to Schwartz, the way to maximize freedom is to maximize choice. He points to his local supermarket as an example where you can go in and find 175 different kinds of salad dressing. And foreign folks come to the U.S. and go to Walmart, and they just like, what is this? I mean, it's true. So even our personal identity has become a matter of choice, Schwartz says. We don't inherit an identity. We get to invent it, and we get to reinvent ourselves as often as we like. And that means that every day when you wake up in the morning, you have to decide what kind of person you want to be. But the question is this true freedom? Does this lead to more happiness? Schwartz ends his talk by pointing to a picture of two fish in a fishbowl, and he says this: the truth of the matter is that if you shatter the fishbowl so that everything is possible, you don't have freedom. You don't have freedom. His point is, of course, that the fish need water. For them to be able to operate freely, they need to be in an environment that they were created to be in. They need water. They can't break the fishbowl, they'll die. That's not freedom. So if you look at the analogy, the biblical analogy of sheep, it's completely irrational to think that a sheep can take care of itself, much less figure out its own identity or figure out its own morality or what have you. This is what's being said. So here we have two completely different views, opposite views of life. Our culture says that you can find meaning and identity within. You can take care of yourself. And the Bible says that we are sheep that desperately need someone to take care of us. So which is right? If you look at the results, which one actually makes more sense? In an online magazine called The Free Press, Jamie Reed, who is a former case manager at the Washington University Transgender Center at St. Louis Children's Hospital, said that she quit last November after 4 years, and here's her quote, because I could no longer participate in what was happening there. What is happening is morally and medically appalling. Reed is not a right-wing ideologue of any kind. She describes herself as queer progressive, and she's married to a trans man. But soon after she started working at the pediatric gender clinic, she was struck by the lack of formal protocols for treatment, leaving physician co-directors as the sole authority. She said little was needed for kids to begin transitioning. A letter of support from a therapist who they had to see only once or twice for the green light, and a single visit for girls to an endocrinologist for a testosterone prescription. So one of their own is denouncing this is where it's going. It's breaking the fishbowl. It's breaking the fishbowl. But this is the road we're on. These are the voices that are screaming in our culture. It's the natural outgrowth of follow what you think is right. And the sheep are being led over the cliff. They're following one another. Consider this. Here's another issue. Consider this from the National Eating Disorder Association. The average woman in America sees about 3,000 ads each day, many of which send messages about what the ideal female body should look like. But 98% of American women are not as thin as the fashion models who supposedly have the right body type. The average American woman is 5'4" and weighs 165 pounds. The average Miss America winner is 5'7" and weighs 121 pounds. It's not surprising then that 42% of first to third grade girls want to be thinner. 81% of 10-year-old girls are afraid of being fat. 70% of 18 to 30-year-old American women don't like their bodies. And 60% of women in middle age still remain unsatisfied with their bodies. 50% of girls are unhealthy weight have unhealthy weight control behaviors, such as skipping meals, vomiting, and taking laxatives. Nearly 20 million women will suffer from an eating disorder at some point in their lives. Brothers and sisters, we can look at them out there, but we have been so thoroughly influenced and saturated by this idea of what's right to you is right. We fall into this category right here. Maybe we don't think of the other one. That's an extreme, but we fall into this one. You see, the thieves that come are not from the pen. Are we sure we know which voice we're listening to? Or are we following the thieves' voice, who's going to take us right over a cliff? That's what he does. So is there another voice that we can listen to? Yes, there is. And it's the shepherd's voice, which is point number three. Verse 11, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Who are you going to listen to? Will you listen to the voices that tell you that you have to be thin and beautiful to be accepted? Well, that's not working out so well. Will you listen to the voices that say that you can find peace and happiness inside of yourself by being free to make any choice you want? Well, anxiety is off the charts. The levels are at an all-time high because no one can look inside of themselves and be certain of anything. Who will we listen to? Well, let me tell you what Jesus is telling you. He says, I love you as you are, not as you should be, though I'm working on it, but I love you as you are. I accept you with all your warts, all of your sinful tendencies, all of your waywardness, all of your fear, all of your anger, all of your helplessness, with the body type that you have. I love you. I accept you. And I've laid down my life for you. And by the way, no one takes my life. None of them took my life. I lay it down for you. Is there any other voice out there that would do that for you? That would lay down their life for you? I don't think so. See, Jesus Christ came to a broken world and laid down his life on the cross to pay the debt that we owe because we have followed so many paths that seemed right. Many of us have gone off the cliff and bounced off. We're alive because of others that have gone down. We bounced off the other sheep. Jesus Christ came to a broken world and laid down his life for us. Remember what I talked about regarding the things that have to happen for sheep to have rest? They can't have fear, conflict, parasites, or hunger. So the good shepherd will deal with your fear problem. Are you facing fear right now? You know you can't control your circumstances. You need to stop trying to and accept that you're not in charge, but that he is, and he's bringing you through whatever you're facing. After all, we're just sheep. He doesn't promise that you won't go through the valley of the shadow of death, but he does promise to go with you. He's been there. And he is really sovereign over all your circumstances, and he loves you. Will you trust him? He also deals with conflicts. Are you in the middle of a conflict? Could be at work, could be at home, could be with your wife or with your husband, could be with your children, could be with your extended family. You have no ability to fix anything, but he is the great fixer. He might call you to do something very hard, but he is the one who ultimately fixes things. Are you willing to do what he has called you to do? Something he himself has done? To die to your own wants and needs for the sake and love of the other person. It's not for their sake, it's for Jesus' sake. He laid down his life for you. He'll deal with the flies and the parasites. Are you in a circumstance that you have no control over? Is it robbing you of your peace? Jesus is calling you to accept your situation and let him deal with it. Accept that he's sovereign over your life and you're passing through exactly what he wants you to pass through. Adverse circumstances are actually his specialty. He's not surprised by what you're going through, but he has orchestrated the events for you because he loves you. Can we accept that? Why would he change our circumstances before we come to the place of complete surrender and say, whatever you want, dear shepherd? And he will deal with your hunger. Is your soul empty? Come to me, he says, and I will give you rest. I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never hunger and will never thirst. Have you tried to fill the hunger and the thirst with sex or with relationships or with greed or with comfort or with ease or with position or status or a million other things? Is this what you've tried to fill the hunger with? But Jesus says, come unto me. If you do, you will never hunger and you will never thirst again. Annie J. Flint was born on Christmas Eve in 1866. Her mother died 3 years later. She was raised by foster parents who died when she was very young. She obtained work as a teacher but developed arthritis that became so severe it rendered her an invalid, unable to work. Annie supported herself as a poet. She suffered for more than 40 years, and her fingers were so bent and her joints so swollen that she could write only with great pain. Listen to one of the poems that she wrote. He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To added affliction, he addeth his mercy. To multiplied trials, his multiplied grace. When we have exhausted our store of endurance, when our strength has failed ere the day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving is only begun. Fear not that thy need shall exceed his provision. Our God ever yearns his resources to share. Lean hard on the arm everlasting, availing. The Father both thee and thy load will upbear. His love has no limits. His grace has no measure. His power no boundary known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. That's the gospel. And it changes everything. Let's pray.